You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
In this month's episode, we introduce longtime author and editor for Hadean Press, Brian Johnson, discussing several of his published texts, from Naming the Heavens, his translation of the planetary orisons of the Summa Sacra Magicae, his translation of Testament of Solomon, Recension C, one of the precursors of the Grimoire tradition, and his translation of excerpts from the Bibliotheca Medice Lorenziana, Manuscript Plut 89, Supplement 38, titled Necromancy in the Medici Library. In this episode, Brian and I discuss how he came to translate these texts, their history, how magical manuscripts evolve over time, and speculate about their origins. I am your host, Matt Hadfield, and I am very happy to welcome Brian Johnson to the Hadean Press podcast. Brian, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for having me.
So for our audience, could you tell us a little about yourself and about how you got interested in the occult?
So I am a freelance translator, editor, and writer. I work primarily in the spaces of historical magic studies and separately tabletop role-playing games. Though now that I think about it, the juxtaposition of those two things probably actually says quite a bit about how I got here. I've loved fantasy fiction for as long as I can remember, and at a pretty early age that led me to discovering the folklore and mythologies that are behind all of those paperback novels and cartoons. And then I basically proceeded to exhaust the entire folklore and mythology section of my local public library. But that pattern has basically just continued for my whole life. I'm fascinated with learning where ideas and beliefs come from, how cultural traditions are constructed. It's why I ended up majoring in anthropology in college. As for magic and the occult specifically, those always seemed to pretty naturally follow any minimally in-depth exploration of spiritual beliefs or folk knowledge. You know, one culture's religion or medicine is often another's sorcery, or even the same culture's sorcery in a different century. So looking at them from the outside with a certain degree of cultural relativism, I gradually came to the view that all of these cosmologies, different frameworks for thinking about how reality works, whether they're characterized as religions or sciences or magic, are just differently limited attempts at describing the essentially indescribable experience of existence. And at that point, it's not a huge leap to treating magical practices, either historical ones or contemporary, as valid modes of interacting with that experience, which are just as worthy of investigation as their more theoretical beliefs that inform them. Of course, all of this is just my reflecting after the fact on a lifetime of experiences and decisions that kind of just happened to me without any real sense of a bigger picture or a particular direction that I was heading in. So I very well might think about it differently in another 40 years from now.
So, Brian, I'd like to start today's interview on your work from Hadean Press with your pamphlet Naming the Heavens from our Guides to the Underworld series. It has, up until the upcoming publication of Dr. Stephen Skinner's translation of the Summa Sacra Medicae, been the only easily available in-depth translation of any part of this hugely important text. This pamphlet has been very important to my own personal work of engaging with the spirits of time, but for our audience, could you describe what it was that led you to translate this specific section of the Summa?
My interest in actively looking at the Summa, or the SSM for short, actually came when David Rankin asked me to assist with translating the book's table of contents, which it appears in the Castle University manuscript of the Summa, for his Grimoire Encyclopedia. I had been broadly familiar with what the SSM was before that, just from reading the secondary literature, but I didn't really have a clear idea of what it actually contained in any detail. So when I saw that part of it dealt with some kind of prayers to the planets, that immediately grabbed my interest as, you know, an example of what we might call comparative cosmological thought. In this case, what exactly did a, you know, notionally Christian medieval magician think he was doing exactly when he talked to the planets? And then upon actually starting to read those prayers, I found that they kind of tied together a whole scheme of cosmological naming, different names for the planets in each zodiac sign, each season, names of the days of the week in each season, and then changing depending on whether it's day or night. It's all extremely complex and actually essential to the magical system that the author lays out in the book. Thankfully, given what I know now, I was able to restrain myself from attempting to translate the whole thing and decided to just be content with making sense of the part that first drew me in.
Yeah, and I think I speak for most people interested in grimoire studies when I say that I genuinely cannot wait for Skinner's translation later this year.
Yep, same.
So if we speculate for a moment, do you think that this level of complexity that you mentioned is a late pagan survival, or is it like is it a Christian innovation within the text?
I think it's most likely at least an innovation of the Christian era, probably growing out of the kind of, you know, complex disputations of a university education at the time. That would be my guess.
So we know the Sefer Razielis was very influential to Ganel, the author of the Summa, and that it entered the Latin and Castilian-speaking West through the translation efforts of those under Alfonso X in 1259. But what can you tell us about these names of the seasons and the planets? And to what degree did Ganel innovate on this text in forming his synthesis?
So this one isn't easy to answer, partly because, as far as I know, the earliest Latin manuscripts of the Book of Raziel have not been published, let alone translated. So my assessment is based entirely on my own very limited review of one of those manuscripts, which was Vatican Regius Latinus 1300. along with some of the much later English editions. But that being said, it seems to me that Gunnell must have been drawing upon lists of names which were related to those in the early Latin Razielus, but also incorporating material from other sources of the same general kind, probably also from Iberian Arabic translations. Maybe even including some form of the Sefer HaRazim, which contains kind of analogous lists of angelic names. Just to choose one arbitrary example of what I'm talking about, if we look at the names of the hours of the night, which can be used indiscriminately in any season, three of the 12 names that Gunnell uses are the same as those in the corresponding list from the Razielus, although one of them is shifted out of place by an hour. Now, that's not a huge crossover, but 25% is still too much to be a coincidence. The problem is that figuring out exactly where all these names came from would be a pretty massive undertaking of research and textual comparison, which I have not had time to do.
Yeah, and I'm really interested in a lot of the names presented in your breakdown of the hours and the seasons, but most of all by the names of the permutations of the planets in the zodiacal signs. Like I shared that document with you a while back where I broke down the names and I found this modularity to them that indicates that perhaps there's some kind of gematria involved in their construction. So I guess I'm just really keen to learn more about how these names came about and how they're formed. And it's really fascinating to trace them through history. But yes, like you said, the 25% is not an insignificant number. And as most grimoire nerds know, names have a tendency to drift and skip and jump across registers. So yeah, we see a lot of that in the transmission of the grimoires, and it seems like a natural part of their evolution. So while the specific names found here get switched around and changed over time, it's the same technique in the SSM that we find in later texts, like, say, the Heptameron, where we find the very, very similar lists of names of the seasons, of the day and of the night. However, we seem to have lost a lot of that complexity in the transmission. Why do you think this is?
I think there are two possibilities, and they are probably both active in, you know, varying chains of transmission. One is people simply finding that it's not necessary to in their experience of the practice. And the other is what's probably more typical of the entire grimoire tradition, which is people copying the parts that they personally need and leaving out the parts that they already know and don't need a mnemonic for, and then other people picking up their notes and thinking it's the entire system.
Yeah, we see a lot of that, don't we? Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah, going back to the Skinner's translation of the Summa, though, it's very exciting to find out exactly the whole broader picture in which these names of the seasons and the days and the hours are embedded within. So, yeah, really excited for this. In many ways, the manner magic is being undertaken here is in this part of the Summa is strikingly similar to Byzantine magic, such as what's found, say, in the Hygromantia, the precursor to the more well-known genre of the Key of Solomon. And this is especially noticeable in the way the orations to the planets are structured within the Summa. For instance, the planets have a named spirit, and they involve the Aristotelian elements and astrological concepts. Even pagan names, pagan god names, such as like Diana, is given for the moon, as well as the recitation of sequences of Nomina Barbara. Although we have second-hand descriptions of texts, there are little to no earlier surviving textual examples of such magical documents that describe this incredibly complex model of reality. To what degree do you think that this is a shared, perhaps even a universal understanding of magical cosmology in the medieval world?
I think it was a generally shared worldview, at least among people who had some level of formal education in the sciences, because it's basically the cosmology they inherited from Aristotle and Ptolemy, where the effects in the sublunar world of the elements are induced by the movements and activities of the perfect unchangeable bodies in the heavens, which also, according to interpreters like Albert the Great and Thomas Aquinas, were themselves moved by rational souls, which some thinkers classified as angels. And if we accept that premise, then it's not hard to see why magicians would seek means of attracting the goodwill of those intelligences, probably first of all by finding names to call them by, even if those names happen to be the same ones that the pagans had once used for them.
So I know that we can say for certain that the centers of learning in the medieval world taught the Aristotelian physics and a Ptolemaic cosmology, especially at the House of Wisdom in the 9th century during the Abbasid Caliphate, which saw a vast amount of Hellenic Greek texts being translated into Arabic. And later in the 12th to 15th century in Europe, the European universities of France and Spain, Italy, and which they translated in turn those Arabic texts into Latin. And through this reintroduction of classical Greek thought, we see this really profound effect on the manner in which magic was performed. But I'm curious about whether or not there is any material here or any evidence for, say, a magical tradition which predates these translation efforts in Europe specifically, and which may have ultimately...
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Blended into what is now called the grimoire tradition.
I think there certainly were magical traditions that survived from the, you know, even the pre-Roman era in Europe, but I don't know that they are represented in this kind of text. I don't know how big of a part, like, any kind of like folk spirit names or anything like that show up in something like the SSM. They might. I don't know how we would know.
Yeah, I'm really fascinated in the idea that perhaps there is some kind of influence going on there, that these translations were coming in and then they've somehow potentially blended with or mixed in with other magical traditions that may have survived from, like you said, all the way back from pre-Roman, you know, Hellenic Egypt on the European continent before this translation effort really picks up again. So, yeah, I think it's really interesting, specifically because we have so little evidence of magical practices in Europe that predate what, the 12th century.
Yeah, that's probably fair to say.
Yeah, like there's like a textual gap that. And the texts that we do have are, say, like the Coptic manuscripts, or like the later books of that you find in like the Greek magical papyri. But the style of magic is, while there may be some kind of similarities in the philosophy of them, the way that they're executed, like the Aristotelian cosmos, etc., there's something that's just so uniquely different about them compared to this later, very book based. Highly refined astrological magic that we see in Ganel and later on throughout Europe. So, yeah, I was just curious about your thoughts.
On that count, I think part of it could even be due to Carolingian court. There was a fairly major effort at educational reform. I'm forgetting the name of the cleric who was largely responsible for that, but I think that really could have set off a might be too much to call it a revolution, but a major change in the way that knowledge was structured and transmitted, is the best way I can think to put it. And that's going to trickle down into every area of learning, including magic. So, I mean, that could have something to do with why a medieval grimoire looks similar, but at the same time, very different from like the Egyptian magical papyri.
Cool. Yeah, I think that's an interesting area that deserves a bit more extra study, or we should look into that a bit more. Yeah. So let's go back in time then to around the 5th century of the Common Era, where we find your next text, which is considered to be the progenitor of really the entire edifice of Solomonic magic, the Testament of Solomon. What was it that drew you to translating this really fascinating document?
So, if I recall correctly, and keep in mind this was over 6 years ago now, at the time I was very interested in trying to trace the textual transmission and evolution of various spirit names. And I believe I first encountered a reference to Recension C of the Testament of Solomon in Jake Stratton Kent's Pandemonium. And I can't remember at this point precisely what the context was or why I then felt compelled to go searching for it, but I found that it only existed in an untranslated Greek edition. And at that point, some combination of curiosity, boredom, maybe a perverse desire to do something with the Greek I learned in college, made me start pecking away at it. This was actually back when I was a archaeological field technician, and I had a lot of long weekends in hotel rooms to work on something like this.
Nice, nice. Yeah, Jake's Pandemonium is an absolute benchmark in the study of spirits. Highly recommended if you don't have it already. I was also definitely really interested in Recension C due to the inclusion of names. The names of the four kings, Oriens, Amaemon, Paimon, Egin, etc. There are also a handful of spirits that people will recognize from very modern grimoires as well, such as the Ars Goetia. Their natures and offices are very different at this point in history, though, but it's quite amazing how these specific spirits have survived and evolved through the manuscript tradition.
It is. You mentioned the significant changes into how some of them are described, which I think that can, in some cases, probably be chalked up to copyists' mistakes. But at the same time, different practitioners have very different experiences of these individuals.
So, could you describe something of the Testament to our listeners, and what is it that makes it distinct from the other recensions? What is unique about your translation of Recension C?
Okay, the Testament of Solomon is a narrative which exists in a number of different textual variants dating back to the 4th century and earlier. They're written as King Solomon's first-person account of how the Archangel Michael gave him a magic ring that would allow him to compel the obedience of demons. This is after Solomon had prayed for help with curing one of the laborers working on the temple in Jerusalem, who was apparently suffering from a demonically induced illness. Solomon uses the ring to summon a veritable parade of demons. And he learns each one's name, what sort of illnesses or other disasters it inflicts upon humanity, and by what angel or other means each one can be thwarted. And he then subsequently puts them to work, basically helping build the temple. Long story short, everything is going great until the epilogue, where we learn that Solomon was eventually tempted into making sacrifices to the gods of one of his wives, and hence lost God's grace. So he says he wrote the testament as basically a kind of atonement slash warning to posterity. Now, Recension C differs from most other versions of the narrative in that about halfway through chapter 10, one of the demons, to avoid being tortured by Solomon's ring, literally writes him what looks like a medieval Liber Spiritum. It contains a list of 52 demons with their seals written in it. It says by their own hand, along with how many other demons they rule and what kind of services they can provide. The rest of the narrative then is also much abbreviated from other versions. It mainly recounts some prophecies the demons deliver regarding the danger of allowing this material to fall into the hands of future generations, and then Solomon hiding it away. Although there is also a brief interlude with the demon Onoskelis delivering him a magical food-producing table, and also some instructions for using an inscribed jasper stone as part of the method for commanding these demons.
As a narrative, is this text prescriptive? As in, should the would-be sorcerer read the story and engage with it as an active myth, like forming the ring, performing the conjurations as described in the story, or was this more of a story as like a warning to people who would attempt to perform sorcery?
Realistically, and I think this applies to both versions of the testament, I don't think it's actually a warning. Except possibly in the loosest sense that you should, that to be an effective magician, you do need to maintain God's grace. I think that may be implicit here. But no, I think in both cases, these are explicit instructions for how to deal with demons that are causing you problems.
So historically, how did this document form? It's far older than the extant textual evidence, which is, what, the 15th century? So what can you say about the oral tradition which underpins it?
So I think the testament is best understood as something closer to a literary genre than a particular text. The exact origin of the narrative as we have it is uncertain, but there are similar tales about Solomon that appear in the Talmud, and there are parallels to the testament's demonological material in Egyptian, Near Eastern, and Greek sources. The earliest relatively complete versions that actually still survive do date to the 15th century, but there are textual references to something called a Testament of Solomon that are recorded already in the late 4th century, and evidence within the text itself indicates a definite Christian influence, despite the fact that the narrative is set during the United Monarchy of Israel sometime in the 10th century BC. It's most likely that pieces of the Testament as we now have it circulated independently for probably hundreds of years and kind of cross-pollinated one another as the people who were copying them more or less gradually settled upon a fixed narrative framework outlining the story arc of King Solomon, which by that time had become, you know, popular cultural currency from the Bible, the Talmud, folklore.
So in other examples of the Testament of Solomon, we are presented with a catalogue of 36 demons, which are specifically of the deacons. And these have a very specific Egyptian origin and connect these chthonic spirits very much to the stars. However, in your work, we find a list of 52.
That's right.
You write, "I suggest that the list of 52 demons, far from being arbitrarily inserted in order to bulk out an otherwise slim work of pseudepigraphia, is in fact the original Goetic core, around which material from the by then classic Testament of Solomon narrative was later wrapped sometime in the 15th century in order to provide a literary context for its transmission. Could you elaborate and expand further on this?
So this obviously gets very complicated. I think I spent over a dozen pages just trying to outline the evidence for it in the introduction to my translation. And there are allusions also to possible textual parallels to this kind of material going back to at least the 12th century in Byzantium. But my basic theory is that the spirit list of Recension C was originally an independent document of practical exorcistic magic, like many others that no doubt existed, with the examples we'd find today in the grimoires being the few that survived. And this list came to be inserted into a modified version of the Testament narrative by some anonymous magician scribe sometime probably around the early 15th century, somewhere in the Greek-speaking Mediterranean, possibly southern Italy, basically in order to improve its chances of being preserved. The manuscript tradition of Recension C itself is also literally physically connected to two manuscripts of the Hygromantia, the so-called magical treatise of Solomon. Those are Parley 5596 and Parasinus Graecus 2419, which were written around the same time and containing some of the actual same ritual paraphernalia that's mentioned in Recension C, which I think further suggests that this text was understood to be of a practical nature and not just biblical apocrypha.
That's fascinating. So the Greek magical texts coming into Europe around that time had such a vast impact on the evolution of the grimoire tradition. So why would you say that the Testament is important to our understanding of the later grimoire tradition?
I think the Testament generally, and Recension C specifically, is one of the closest things we have to a direct genealogical link between some of the ritual methods and materials of the Egyptian magical papyri and the late antique Hellenistic world as a whole, on one hand, and the spirit registers and conjurations of the medieval grimoires on the other. That's one of the main points I tried to emphasize in the introductory material and probably too many footnotes of my.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Translation.
No, Brian, there can never be enough footnotes. But yeah, this is such a fascinating subject to explore. And, you know, there's still so much more that I would love to go over with you. But yeah, I really love this book. The Testament of Solomon, Recension C, is gorgeous as well and well worth people's attention. So it offers this amazing window into like this early phase of the evolution of the grimoires. So yeah, thank you so much, Brian, for producing it and for all of your efforts into bringing this into the English language. It's a really wonderful book. Moving on then to your translation of excerpts from the Bibliotheca Medicae Lorenziana, manuscript Lut 89, supplement 38, titled Necromancy in the Medici Library, an amazing glimpse into the nefarious sorcery, which was very much a part of the medieval Italian life. What can you tell us about the history of this text?
So this manuscript, which is basically a huge collection of miscellaneous magical texts, was compiled sometime around the turn of the 16th century. At least one part of it is internally dated to 1494, though the manuscript seems to have been written by several different hands, so its date of final completion is not certain. It contains a number of operations also found in the roughly contemporaneous Munich Manual of Demonic Magic, CLM 849, as well as some other texts mentioned by Trithemius in his 1508 Antipalus Maleficorum. And there are even a few examples of texts found in English libraries at the time, which I think all gives a pretty good sense of the extent of the networks that texts like this were circulating through at the time. The shelf mark designation Pluteus, that actually indicates that the book would have been among those that were already part of the Medici collection when the library was formally established in 1571, though it's not really possible to say when or by whom it was originally acquired. We do know that Giovanni de' Medici, who would go on to become Pope Leo X, was a highly educated man and had people like Marsilio Ficino among his family friends. So he could definitely be a possibility.
So who exactly were the Medicis? Like, how much power did they wield in Italian society?
The Medici were a very wealthy banking and mercantile family who were able to leverage that wealth into political power in the city-state of Florence in the early 15th century, and also then through the appointment of two of their heirs, Giovanni and Alessandro, as popes. Their power did kind of wax and wane over the years. There were a number of coups, assassinations, and a prolonged exile in Rome. But overall, they did remain one of probably the most powerful dynasties in all of Europe for about a century.
And so, who was it then that actually wrote this document? What do we know about them?
As usual, we don't have any concrete personal details. The most likely candidate, which also, as usual in this era and this type of material, was probably a member of the lower clergy, given the necessary combination of both education and free time. Again, there may have been more than one scribe at work here, in which case it's kind of interesting to speculate that the manuscript might have even been the common property of a monastic community. But again, unfortunately, we don't really know.
We know that the document itself was within the Medici library. Can we say with any certainty that it was actually employed or used by them?
I don't think so. I really don't. It's a massive library. Even at that time, there were over 3,000 volumes in the Pluteus collection. So it's hard to say how many of those books were even ever looked at by anyone other than the librarian.
It's a shame, really, because all of this conjures such a vivid image of necromancy being used in political machinations, assassinations, and power grabs, like you mentioned, which were so common during this period of Italian history. And yes, some of the content of the book as well is really dark. Some of the materia involved, for instance, and actually, yeah, we should get onto that now because often the rituals outlined in this text are described as dangerous, if not potentially fatal to the sorcerer performing them. Can you outline an example of the form of necromancy within this text?
Sure. So the rituals mainly follow the to anyone familiar with grimoires, the classic exorcistic pattern of invoking divine empowerment and then commanding demonic agents to do whatever you want them to do. Though the operations here also do incorporate elements of sympathetic magic, like wax effigies of your intended victim, and also some more complex than usual astrological timing. The purposes of the conjurations are also pretty typical of the genre, and typically malefic. There are the coercive sex spells, psychological attack spells, Though some are more neutral, like the potentially fatal one you mentioned, which is to actually acquire a cloak of invisibility.
It's the first spell that you list in the text, right?
Yes, that's the first one I excerpted.
It's usually the first spirit of a catalog provides invisibility to the operator. So I was just curious about that one point.
I had not even thought of that. In fact, the texts as I include them in my translation are in the order that they appear in the text. And basically that is just the chunk of text that I decided to excerpt, both because it appeared to be by the same scribe and was all thematically somewhat related. But in that operation, basically it directs the magician to go through the usual period of purification. And then when the moon is waxing on a Wednesday, first you draw this complex circle featuring the names of several demons, which is illustrated in the manuscript. And then follows the invocation and conjuration. Then when the demons arrive, you'll actually exchange the garment you're wearing for the cloak that they give you. But then 3 days later, you have to come back to the same location and reclaim your garment and incinerate it. Otherwise, you will somehow die 7 days later. And this is just my opinion, but I do get a really strong vibe. And this actually, now that I think about it, kind of reminds me of your speculation about native European folklore kind of seeping into the grimoires. But this really does give me a vibe of the kind of lethal mischief and gift exchange that we get in a lot of fairy folklore, which I think is very interesting here.
It really does have something of that essence to it, doesn't it? There's also a very strong down at the crossroads vibe going on with this spell that I really like. And some of the spells in the Munich manuscript and even in the Hygromantia, like the evocation to the Lady of the Mountains comes to mind. You have to give her a pine cone, I think, and honey. So there's like that, like you said, that gift exchange. And yeah, and I'm really fascinated by this sorcery, which seems to predate, how do I say, the more highly structured cosmological sorts of magic that you find in a lot of the other grimoires, like we mentioned earlier with the Summa. But yes, I really enjoy this text. In your opinion, Brian, do you think this is a text that is workable by the modern magician? Do you think that somebody could actually apply these spells that you've translated here and actually enact them?
I mean, in practical terms, I don't see why not. I mean, there are no especially difficult to acquire materia. I mean, if in one case you may have to get some dove blood on your hands if that's something that makes you uncomfortable, but many grimoires do call for small animal sacrifice. As far as whether or not you should use this kind of material. Self-defense takes many different forms. I before I get myself in legal trouble, I will stop there.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Oh, all right. Well, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast today, Brian, and talking about your various books and pamphlets through Hadean Press. It's been really amazing having the chance to finally get to talk to you. Is there anything that you're currently obsessed with or working on at the moment that you'd like to share with the audience?
I do have a number of projects, both solo and collaborative, that will be featuring my translations. And all are at kind of various nebulous stages of pre-publication right now. But one that I can talk about that might be of interest is a short treatise on stellar talismans written in the early 15th century by the Italian physician and university lecturer Giorgio Anselmi. who is probably actually more well known for his writing on music theory, that looking at that coming out early next year, hopefully. but given present company, I think I probably would be remiss not to mention that I've also just completed what is probably the first English translation of Cecco di Ascoli's commentary on the Sfera Mundi of Johannes de Sacro Bosco, which is going to feature some historical and bibliographic background research by one Matt Hadfield.
Yeah, thank you, Brian, so much. You have helped me greatly with this translation effort, a text which was banned and burned by the Inquisition alongside Cecco di Ascoli himself on the very day of this recording, September the 16th in 1327. Cecco's comment predates the previously mentioned Summa Sacra Magicae, it being written some 19 years after Cecco's death. My goal then has been to attempt as best as I can to reconstruct something of Cecco's library from the sources that he cites, many of which are part of the Arabic Pseudo-Hermetica, and so many of which now today have been lost or the titles have been changed. Yeah, so we go way more into that in the text itself. But in his comment, Cecco describes a form of astrological negromancy, which includes perhaps the earliest ever mention of the four kings, which he connects to the cardinal signs of the zodiac. And I think it really shines a light on where many of the underlying concepts found within the later grimoires originate from. So work on this project continues, but all things going well. I hope to have it completed hopefully by the end of the year. And then, thank you, Brian, so much for being such a boss and agreeing to help me with it.
Absolutely. I had a lot of fun working on it.
Yes, but thank you again, Brian, for coming on. You've been a really amazing guest, and I'm really glad that I got this chance to speak to you.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
That was Brian Johnson, translator and editor of Naming the Heavens, Testament of Solomon Recension C, and Necromancy in the Medici Library. I have been a big fan of Brian's work since he published his translation of the Testament back in 2019, not only because of the quality of his work, but also because he is so interested in many of the same areas of grimoire studies as myself. Brian has a very sharp eye for detail and an excellent understanding, not only of the material itself, but of the surrounding historical background which clothes these enigmatic texts. I really enjoyed our discussion about the manner in which information itself became codified, as well as exploring the hints and clues of a pre-Christian, pre-Aristotelian magical undercurrent to the grimoires through passages and spells which resemble something of fairy lore, as well as generally just unpacking the history and the context of these amazing magical documents. I really can't recommend Brian's work highly enough. If you are a fan of critical and highly polished examinations of medieval magical manuscripts, then you are truly in for a treat. All of Brian's works mentioned in today's episode are available from Hadean Press through the links which can be found in the description below. Once again, to all of those that have listened all the way through to the end, myself and everyone at Hadean Press, thank you for your keen interest in our work and our output. Please do all the things, like, subscribe, comment, and share our podcast and our promotional videos around with people that you think will appreciate what we do. It really makes a difference as we continue to put out some of the best material on the subject of magic, grimoires, and folklore. Stay tuned for more to come in the future. We have an extra spooky episode on necromancy coming up for the month of October, which I'm very excited to share with everyone. And yes, thank you all so much for your continued support. And I will see you all again in the next one.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.